What's going on, everybody? How are you doing? Welcome back to episode 2 of Green Stock Talks. I'm calling this episode Dear Jack because I reached out to my listeners and asked for them to write questions for me to answer on the show. So I'm going to go ahead and jump straight into that. First, I have a question from Prohibition 2.0 on Instagram who asks, Dear Jack, what inspires you to continue to grow? That's a great question. Many things inspire me to continue growing. First and foremost, Lady Greenstock. She's my constant companion, and she's actually the one who inspired me to get back into growing in the first place. We are both medical cannabis users. We both have a doctor's recommendation for medical cannabis, so I'm primarily growing for our medical needs. We love hunting through different varieties that we think might be beneficial for our medical needs, and so I pop a lot of seeds to try and find stuff that might work even better than the stuff that our buddies have as clones in their gardens or clones that we hold in our own library. So that's the primary reason that I continue to grow. But I also have, since starting the Jack Greenstock Instagram account, met a lot of growers online and connected with them and been able to share and learn and grow myself and help others, like brand new growers or even experienced growers, just try and better their own grow game and help everybody get their best quality product that they can produce. So I've learned so much since I got online on Instagram. I've also joined at Cannabuzz, or it's at Get Cannabuzz on Instagram. It's a new app made by cannabis-friendly people for cannabis people, and they have some cool subtopics like microgrowing, which is one that I'm very interested in, and I've joined that sort of sub-forum, and I can scroll and see all the other microgrowers, but they have other things like organic, LED growers. They have a whole bunch of different sections, and you also know you're not going to get your posts deleted or comments deleted or reported because they're cannabis, and it goes against the terms of service of things like Instagram. I've also joined Twitter, so you can find me on Twitter at @Jack_Greenstock, because @Jack Greenstock was already taken. But that's all right. So it's a place that I can post some of the sort of highlights. Just in case my Instagram does get deleted, I'll be able to use those other platforms to let you know whatever my new Instagram account will be, because I have recently run into some issues with posts being removed and comments being deleted. They won't tell me what posts, which is a little bit strange, because I've never offered to sell cannabis. On Instagram, I've only shared advice and posted pictures of my personal legal medical grow logs. So, with that said, I think that is about all of the things that I can think of right now that inspire me to continue growing, so I'm going to move on to the next question. 50s Thrifties says, I would love to hear more about VPD and bricks. Thank you, Jack. So, the first thing I'm going to cover is VPD, or vapor pressure deficit. Vapor pressure deficit is something that you can follow when you're growing. This is something that you can find online if you Google VPD for cannabis. There are two different graphs to make sure to check out. There is a VPD chart for veg stages of growth, and there's a VPD chart for flower stages of growth. Some combine them into one single chart, but I prefer the ones that are separate because the two separate stages of growth have different requirements for VPD, in my opinion. So, when you're growing with VPD, it's talking about the temperature and relative humidity in the room in relation to each other. Those two things directly impact how the plant is able to transpire. And so, if you are looking at this graph, something like a grow room is typically around, let's say, 78 to 80 degrees on a hot side. And in those cases, you would want the relative humidity to be a little bit warmer because the plant wants to be able to transpire. And having the RH a little bit higher in the room, like in the mid-60s and even low 70s in some cases in veg, is okay in warmer rooms. The plants actually seem to thrive and grow very well under those conditions, despite some of the older knowledge, which might lead one to believe you should grow with much lower relative humidities and have different temperature ranges. So this is something that's sort of a new wave thing in cannabis. A lot of the old school growers don't follow VPD because they're worried that they'll get mold and mildew and other issues. And that can happen if you're not diligent about creating a good amount of airflow by having fans, both exhaust fans, intake fans, and fans to oscillate and move air throughout the room so there's no stagnant pockets of vapor building up to make you potentially susceptible to molds and mildews and things like that. Getting to part two of your question, talking about bricks, I have a few thoughts about bricks and bricks ratings. For those who don't know, bricks is measuring the sugar content of an aqueous solution. So this is done by taking a sample of a leaf of a cannabis plant and squishing it and looking at something through, I believe it's called a refractometer, and it gives you a rating between 1 and like 24 or something. And you look through this little scope after you've squeezed the plant juice out, and it tells you your Brix rating. Some organic and soil growers will tell you a Brix rating of like 12 or 14 or higher indicates that you have a healthy plant. We've taken this from the wine industry. The wine growers use Brix ratings to determine the sugar content of their grapes. And so this is sort of a adaptation to the cannabis culture. And so I have not seen the scientific data to support Brix yet. But that being said, I do have a friend on Instagram. He is at rust.brandon. He also joins the Growing with My Fellow Growers live podcast on Sundays occasionally with us. And he has very high Brix ratings. He grows in living organics and uses things like Bokashi, EM1, and he has a really thriving living soil, and he does Brix ratings with his plants, and he gets them up in the 20s sometimes and has really active soil. So with that being said, he also gets his cannabis tested at a place called Farm Labs in San Diego, and he's had terpene test results on flower of 5%, 7%, and as high as 12%, which might be a little controversial for some, but when I look at the cannabis plant, I think a legitimate test, typically I see top out around 30 to 35% THC, or just total cannabinoids. And I think that those percentages are often shared. So in his test results, the THC was about 17% when the terpenes were 12%, so equaling about 30%. It wasn't like he was claiming 40 or 50% total cannabinoids in dry flower like some people are. So I think that his test results very well could be extremely legitimate, and it could be a testament to growing in high Brix soil. Doc Bud's High Brix on Instagram has come on the Cheap Home Grow podcast and advocated for growing with high Brix as well. I think if you're not growing in soil, if you're growing hydroponically or if you're growing in coco, then your Brix ratings may be lower, and I don't necessarily think that this indicates that you have a worse plant. I think that you can grow in many different mediums and have a lot of different successes. And I think I've seen extremely high terpene test results in coco and in hydroponics. So growing in deep water culture or rock wool or any other different method you can think of. So Brix ratings, although they may correlate with a healthy plant or, you know, a high sugar rating, I guess, a plant that has high sugar content, whether or not that is solely beneficial or needed is unknown for me, but I think that is something people are looking into, and the more measurements you have on a plant, the better idea you can have of sort of its plant health, and you can get measurements over time and see what inputs affect things like that differently. So I do like that people are out there gathering data on it, but I personally do not test my Brix ratings. SafeLabs420 asks, I'd like to talk about final flush. So I have a few thoughts about the final flush. I have tried cannabis that is flushed versus cannabis that is not flushed. And I'm talking about when grown with either soilless medium using bottled or powdered nutrients. Some would call this synthetic nutrients, but they do have them available in organic. Now, when people grow using these types of nutrients, I do encourage them to, at least for the last week, maybe two or even more than that, depending on their line, flush, because although I have seen a scientific test that says the nutrients within the cannabis buds and the leaves are no different from a flushed plant versus an unflushed plant, in my anecdotal experience of trying cannabis that's flushed versus cannabis that is not flushed, the flushed cannabis, which is not given nutrients for the final week or 2 weeks, it tastes much better. It smokes smoother in my experience. It's not as harsh on the throat. It often smells better, and it often burns a little bit cleaner. Some people talk about the white ash. I'm not sure if this is what influences that. I think that could be related to the dryness, the amount of water content in the bud, and how hot you smoke the bud at. Like if you use a jet lighter, the little blue torch lighters, those will get your ash a lot whiter than if you're smoking with a low temperature burning thing like a hemp wick. So something to think about, or even a Bic lighter, a traditional lighter in that case. So as far as the final flush is concerned, there is a little bit of science out there, but it says that there is no difference, but I think most people who grow and smoke cannabis would come to the conclusion that there is a difference, and that's why you see most people flushing. But it also may be because that's doing something to either the biology in the soil or something to the plant itself, just by lowering the EC, electrical conductivity in the soil, that could trigger a reaction or a response in the plant that thinks it's like, oh, it's the end of my life, I need to trigger this fade and sort of have the leaves get that fall color that you often see towards harvest time in some people's gardens. Making It Up 101 asks on Cheap Home Grows reposts, he says, I've assessed various sources, sounds deep, but talking basic YouTube, Pinterest, and contradictory techniques and info is frustrating. Just clearing out the BS would be highly beneficial to everyone, I think. Thinking there has to be a point where one more cola is a waste of time, energy of the plant. There must be a limit, of which I have no idea. And am I mistaken? What would be the prudent path? So I think I get what you're asking here about if you continue to top a plant and continue to make more top colas, isn't there going to be a point where the bud won't be as dense and you won't get as nice of a big, beautiful, sexy top cola? And I agree that, yes, there is. The prudent path is trial and error. So with your particular cultivars in your garden, you're going to have to figure out what works best for you. Some people like to run a sea of green where they don't top the plant at all, and they have a bunch of small single cola plants, and it's all just basically one top cola. And other people like to do fill out a 4x4 or a 5x5 with a single plant. There's a guy on Instagram called the Scrog King 2.0 who gets like 2 pounds out of a single plant in a 4x4 by making it have several tops. But all those tops are not as large, I'll admit, as somebody who is growing in a sea of green and just getting single top cola buds. But there is a middle ground where if you just top once or twice or a few different times, or use some of the different mainline and manifold techniques that are available, you can get several chunky, healthy, fat top buds on a plant if you give it enough space within the grow room, if you give it enough space for the roots to grow in the medium, and if you give it adequate water, nutrients, and lighting, because those are all of the limiting factors. If you have it in too small of a pot, people always say bigger roots, bigger fruits. So if you want more yield and larger buds, then you're going to need a bigger pot. So that often requires more space and things to regulate your environment accordingly. So if you're trying to grow and grow the biggest, fattest buds on every single plant, just try and do some trial and error with the cultivars you have. See how it does with 8 top colas versus 16 top colas versus 4 top colas, and see which one you like the most and go with that. On that same Cheap Home Grow post, Sour Diesel Tangy asks, by the way, shout out to Cheap Home Grow again, because there's a lot of engagement on that post. I'm not going to say it every single time for the rest of the episode, but a lot of these comments do come from his repost of my episode post asking for questions. So, Sour Diesel Tangy asks, Dear Jack, hell yeah, I'm in. Harvest time. Hang branches or entire plant? Wash buds or not? I couldn't tell the difference. Wet trim or dry trim? Can you reuse Pro Mix after the harvest? So, that is a lot of questions, but I will go through them sort of one by one. Hang branches or entire plant? I prefer to hang the entire plant. If you have the space, I like doing what's called a whole plant hang, which we'll go to a later part in your question. I've done experiments with dry trim versus wet trim. I think that both can work excellently, but if you dry trim, you have to understand the plant is going to be drying much more quickly. So if you can slow down the environment every single way that you can, to ensure that you don't get a sort of wet grass or hay smell, because it is possible, but I think that is the chlorophyll that's sort of released when you're doing the wet trim, and that goes away with the cure. And a lot of people criticize wet trimming, but I've done wet trim and dry trim, and if you cure like the proper way in a jar, glass jar, over time, that smell will be non-existent by the time the bud is ready to smoke, and you get amazing smelling cannabis both ways. So going to the wet trim or dry trim part, because I've already started talking about that, I do dry trimming now because I prefer the slower full plant hang. So we cut the plant straight from the very bottom, just above the soil, flip it upside down, and hang it. Now this typically encourages the plant to dry a little bit more slowly because the leaves protect the bud and it makes the moisture release out into the environment more slowly. And I prefer that. The longer and slower the process, the better in my opinion. So that can take anywhere from 10 to 14 days before the plant is ready, sometimes earlier, as short as a week sometimes. And I go based on whenever the smallest stems of the plant start to pop. And when I say pop, I mean they break clean instead of bending, or when it breaks, it has like a skin of a stringy sort of texture. It wants to stay attached to the cola and not break away from the plant clean. If you wait until the top buds, or if you grow like an auto where all of the buds are giant and have fat, giant, huge stems and stalks, this might be a bad metric because you might overdry the bud because the stems are just so beefy that they take a little bit longer to dry than somebody who's able to pop some of the lowers and the larf. And I think when that stuff is ready, then you're ready to go into like a brown paper bag. If you go straight into the jar, you have to be very diligent, maybe burp twice a day. I like to do a brown paper bag because it is a sort of a mediator for the last day or two. And then you go into the glass jars, and I find that method works really well to provide a excellent smell and taste and flavor with a shorter curing time. The bud just tends to smell good earlier than when I do a wet trim. But that being said, I still want to wait for the proper cure time just so the moisture is out of the bud and it smokes as smooth as possible and tastes as good as possible, which I encourage everybody else to. But if it's your medicine and you absolutely need it before it's completely ready, that's fine. I'd say take a little nug or two out and let them like sit around your house in the air and have like a fan blow over that bud and let it dry a little bit before you grind it up, or even grind it up. That helps the moisture release from the bud, and then leave it sitting in the grinder for a while, and that could help encourage it to smoke a little more smoothly. But also using a vaporizer before it's a little bit ready will encourage it to smoke a little bit more smoothly, and the vape is going to give you a little bit better flavor in my experience as well. I prefer a desktop style vaporizer. I use Vapor Brothers VB1. It's old school, but it gets the job done. Wash buds or not? I couldn't tell the difference. Well, I personally do not wash buds. I tried it in the past because I had heard things like it could increase your overall cannabinoid percentage on the plant because you wash away things like dirt and hair and other things, so what's left is the resin. But I also make ice water hash, and when I put bud in the water, I smell some of the terpenes in the water afterwards. And granted, you're shaking that for the hash much more vigorously than you would for a wash. I'm still a little bit skeptical that the bud wash doesn't take away some of the flavor, because when I tried it, although I would say it smoked a little bit more smoothly, I noticed a distinct lack of flavor. And I grow indoors in a relatively clean environment. The only real thing that gets in there is cat hair, which I tweeze off of the buds meticulously while I'm trimming and after I'm trimming and while they're curing in the jars. But other than that, I don't have excessive amounts of things that I'm worried about smoking. In the past, I've tried not bud washing, and people want to say like, oh, skin cells from your arms or your hair or your clothing, the fibers and all this stuff. I microscope the buds. I look at them. I don't see too much on there. I smell them. They look great. And so if it tastes great and looks great and I don't lose the flavor by not washing, then I prefer the no wash technique. The last part of your question was, can you reuse ProMix after the harvest? And this goes for any soilless medium like ProMix, Coco Coir. Yes, you can. It just depends on how you're going about doing it. Some people like to sterilize it, wash it, use a bunch of water, flush out any nutrients that are in there. Some people microwave it to sterilize it. There's a whole lot of different methods that you can use, but it is possible. And I would just encourage, if you are using ProMix and you are using some sort of dry amendments, throw those in there, get the things ready before you have plants in there, and water it, get livened back up before you have any plant life in there. If you're just using bottled synthetics, they provide a much more instant nutrient uptake, so it'd be a sort of excessive if you dose the ProMix and also start feeding it in with the plants. You might get your EC a little bit too high, but you can do that if you want. Just make sure you're measuring your runoff, EC, and pH, and getting everything in the proper ranges. But it is possible to reuse ProMix. There are better, probably more elegantly worded solutions online if you want to go and search those out. Google will help you, but I do know it's possible. Some people don't use it, reuse it. I think it's more because of the inconvenience of having to take the root and root ball out and separate it, and getting perlite and dirt and stuff all over your house is inconvenient. It's more convenient to just throw it away. Some people use it to recycle it for their outdoor vegetable gardens. Whatever you do with it, try and be as eco-conscious as possible. I like the idea that you're trying to reuse. So reduce, reuse, recycle, rethink. These are all good ideas. I think it's better for the planet if you're being conscious about it, which it seems like you already are. So props to you. I'm going to go on to the next question. I apologize if I do have cotton mouth at all during this or any of the episodes. I do use a lot of medical cannabis, and some of the side effects are dry mouth for some of those strains. So this morning I was using Cherry Pie, Chernobyl, aka Slimer, as well as something else that I can't recall right now. But yeah, sorry about the cotton mouth. On to the next question. I've been trying to do little pause breaks and drink as much water as I can so it doesn't come through as much on the mic, but if you do hear that, I apologize. Finger Lakes Finest asks, powdery mildew. It's like the elephant in the room nobody wants to talk about. Ooh, this is a good one. We just had an IPM episode on growing with my fellow growers, so you can go and listen to that and check that out after you listen to this. But I am more than happy to talk about that right here and now. So PM, or powdery mildew, is a common issue for a lot of growers. It can creep up in your grow room because of high humidity. And if the temperature and humidity are not regulated properly, this is something that I see pretty common in new and experienced growers' grow rooms. It's difficult to get rid of once you have it. So I suggest for anybody who does want to get into growing, or people that are already growing right now, if you don't have PM, try and avoid it at all costs. That's the best way. An ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure, is what I've always heard. And so if you can be preventative, like having your grow space in the proper environment, having your RH low enough, like below 65 is probably pretty safe for powdery mildew if you have proper airflow, meaning you have an intake and exhaust fan, so you're providing the plants with fresh air. Because the plants use up carbon dioxide, you need to bring fresh air into the room. I think that the plants do a little bit better if they have refreshed air and you're cycling air in and out of the room. And so with that being said, powdery mildew can spring up because of lack of circulation. If it's stagnant, if it's just trapped in a closet and there's no airflow and it's not getting fans blowing on it, and the RH is up in the 70s and 80s, and during the dark period, it's just sort of breeding grounds for PM. But thankfully, there are some solutions, like in veg. A way to be preventative is to use sulfur. And sulfur is something that can kill PM on contact, but it's not something that you necessarily want to spray when you're in flower. So being preventative, you want to, you know, make sure if you have any in your room or on your plants that you get rid of it before you flip to flower. So number one tip is making sure that your plants are healthy and ready to go, and that your environment is all dialed in before you flip to flower. And then, you know, get deep into flower and you're all excited for your plants, and lo and behold, maybe it's your first grow, you didn't realize you don't have the proper equipment to dial in. Your RH is skyrocketing, it's way too high, late in flower, and you get PM. And that is a bit of a bummer, but it's not the end of the world. Growers like Jorge Cervantes have demonstrated on YouTube how to bud wash your plant with hydrogen peroxide with the specific reason of killing powdery mildew. I've personally never had to try this, but a fellow growing with my fellow growers member, Can, that's C-A-N-C-A-N-N, GROW, Can Can Grow, on YouTube and Instagram, he has dealt with powdery mildew, and that is one of the ways that he's been able to salvage some of his harvests, where he otherwise would have had to throw the buds completely away. So in that case, like, sure, you're going to lose a little bit of flavor. That's fine. Who cares? You're able to at least get some of the smoke, and I think that's much better than nothing. So if you do get PM, it's not the end of the world. There are other products. I've seen things like Mighty Wash, but I think they have pyrethrins and things like that. I'm not sure 100% on that. But look into any of the products that you're using. Make sure you know the chemicals within them. There is a thing called MSDS label sheets. So try and get the most current, up-to-date version of that, because the government should, or at least tries to, force these companies to disclose what they're putting within their products. Some of them hide behind things like being proprietary, so they won't tell you exactly what the mix is, but most times they have to tell you what's in it. They won't tell you the percentage of the mix, maybe, but some of them are able to not disclose certain things, which is unfortunate. So just be very careful with whatever you use or put on your plants. But like I said earlier, prevention is the number one thing. Keeping your climate, temperature, humidity, all those things in the proper ranges. Like if your power goes out, for example, and you don't have a fan moving around and you're not getting any circulation, trying to do something to get into the grow room to make sure you're getting fresh air, maybe open up the tent, make a big piece of cardboard, walk around fanning the plants, do whatever you have to do. But there are ways to prevent powdery mildew before you get it. And that would be my number one piece of advice, because once you get it, it's sort of a pain in the neck and you don't want to have to be constantly battling and firefighting every day. I'd rather just make sure that my plants are in a nice, healthy range, healthy environment. My plants themselves are healthy. And then you don't have to worry about some of the curative solutions. One of the other curative solutions I've heard is that the powdery mildew does not like high pH. Things like even just high pH water can kill powdery mildew, like getting the pH up super, super high and just foliaring the plants with that. I've also heard that they don't like labs, lactoacid bacillus. And so you can make that. Even people have used skim milk to fight powdery mildew. So there are a lot of organic and inorganic methods to going about treating powdery mildew. Whatever you have to do to figure out your own solutions. But it sounds like you may or may not be dealing with it, or you just see a lot of other people are dealing with it and maybe not talking about it. So I'm glad that I was able to try and talk about it and be as honest as possible. I personally have not dealt with it, because I've tried my very, very best to keep my plants in the ideal climate ranges where they will not be vulnerable to the powdery mildew. 710 Jesse 710 asks, will a pollinated female keep budding when put under 18 hours of light, or will it begin to reveg? Now, this is an interesting note, and I don't know if you're just asking this out of curiosity, but the person I have heard talk about this the most is Ethos Genetics at Ethos Colin on Instagram. He, during the last 2 weeks of flower with his pollinated plants, puts them back under 18 hours of light. And he does this sometimes to reveg them or help them get going in the reveg process if he didn't take clones of it and he wants to get clones later on, or just to help increase the amount of seed weight. He's given a whole bunch of different reasons for why he might want to do that, but he claims that that late in flower, it's too late to reveg, especially on a pollinated bud, and that it will increase his overall yields, and that it hasn't negatively impacted his buds in any way. There's no like late flower hermaphrodite that he's worried about. Any earlier, like let's say you can pollinate a female as early as week 2 or 3 of flower when the males start throwing pollen. If there's pistils showing, they can be pollinated by the pollen. So in that case, if you were to flip straight over and the bud sets hadn't formed yet, it's possible that you could get the seeds. I've seen people talk about, you know, doing that and then going back to veg, and you can get those small little sets that may have been pollinated already to produce seeds. But I personally think you would produce many, many more seeds if you allowed the buds to continue to mature in the 12-12 or even 11-13 light cycle, something that would induce flowering. Because when the females are filling out those buds, they just seem to produce a lot more seeds, and they put out more pistils and stigmas, and the stigmas help bring that pollen into the pistil, and the pistil is the actual part of the bract that is pollinated. So some of those terms might be unfamiliar to people. Bract and calyx are often used interchangeably, but bract is the proper term. And pistil is often used interchangeably with stigma or hairs, those furry little things that come out of the buds. But there are only one pistil per bract, which means that is like the part of the bud that can be pollinated. All of those other hairs are technically stigmas, and they're there as gathering agents to help the pollen get onto that reproductive organ, the pistil. Looking back at the comments, I see you say, heard re-veg as well as herm. Be careful, don't want a herm, unless maybe you do. Some people wouldn't mind, but I think most people are trying to avoid seeding their crop unless they're doing it intentionally. That is a whole different practice. Breeding, pollen chucking, reversing things. If it's what your intentions are, then cool, but if not, yeah, you do probably not want to go back to the 18-hour light cycle once your plant has been pollinated. Some people may want to, you know, throw their plant in the veg room once it's pollinated to make space for other things in the flower room, but I personally think better safe than sorry. Just go with the natural process, pollinate the plant when it's ready to be pollinated, let it stay under the flowering light cycle all the way until it's ready to harvest, and maybe even a little bit later. I've even seen some people supplement higher nitrogen in flower for seeded plants in order to help create more mature seeds, like the dark tiger stripe seeds, so they're not getting as many light green or white or gray premature seeds. So those are some tips on things like pollination, and I hope that I adequately answered your questions. Thank you for asking Making It Up 101. Making It Up 101 also asks, shit, I would be happy if I could get better percentage of seed germination. So aggravating. Not just seed cost, but time lost. And I can totally agree with that, because even when you don't buy the seed, I've gotten tester seeds that I was just really looking forward to. And I went with the soil technique because I heard some people were having a lot of success with it, and I was trying to just simplify my life a little bit, planting directly into the medium, which worked for like 4 out of 12 of my seeds that run, which was kind of a bummer because it was 0 out of 5 of one of the testers that I was trying, which was sort of upsetting, because since then I've gone back to my paper towel technique, but I've also added a step, which is using the seed cracker, which you can find on Instagram at the seed cracker, also at Woodshed13. He's the guy who produces them. It's a little piece of handmade machined metal, and it's a basically cannabis seed cracker, and all it is like a twist screw, which you drop your seed into that, and you tighten it down until you hear a pop, but absolutely no further. I tested going a little bit further and crushed one seed. Other than the one that I crushed, I've had 15 out of 15 and 10 out of 10 germination since trying this new method, and it is simply taking 3% hydrogen peroxide and taking 5 milliliters of that, putting it in a bowl of RO water, and then dunking a paper towel in that RO water and setting that on top of a plastic baggie. I take the seeds before cracking them, and I wash them in a little plastic tube that the seed cracker came in, as well as the seed cracker itself, to sterilize everything on the outside of the shell. Because I have seen seeds start to germinate, they pop the tail, but then something kills them off before they're able to successfully grow. So I want to give them the best chance of success, and I've seen studies side by side that show the H2O2 wash can help get like 90% germination, where without it, they're having about 70% germination in some studies. So that was enough to convince me, and since going to that, I've had very, very high success rate. I love the paper towel method. After I crack the seed, I put it in that paper towel that also has some of the H2O2 diluted to the water, and I fold it up. I put it in a baggie, and I hang that baggie in a dark, warm place, and I hang it with the seeds so they're able to pop a taproot that grows downwards with gravity, and that's why I tape it to the inside of a cabinet. And that's shown me to have the best success so far, so that's what I'm going to stick with. And it also helps because when I go to transplant into my medium, I use tweezers, and I can just grab the taproot. It's perfectly straight. I'm very delicate with it, and plant it right into the medium, and within a day or two, everything gets all green and lush under a little T5 or LED light, and then it just goes from there. And I hope that those tips will be able to help you if you're able to get those products. If you can't get the seed cracker product, I've also seen people use medical hemostats, which are a little cheaper, which can help you squeeze the seed until you hear it crack. And also there are like little nutcrackers and almond crackers and things online, like small vices that do a similar concept where it tightens down and you could use it to pop or crack a seed. That would maybe perhaps help germination rates. They have certainly helped my germination rates. This next set of questions comes from the Growing With My Fellow Growers repost on Instagram. First one by Mr._Canna_Farmer. How long does it take for myco to work? So myco, meaning mycorrhizal fungi, can actually have benefits, in my opinion, fairly instantaneously. I prefer to use it on transplants, directly powdered onto the roots. And when I do this, I notice that the plants do not suffer as much of a transplant shock. I've also seen many people use wettable mycose, and they water this into their soil. And I believe that over time, there are a few different ways that the mycorrhiza fungi can activate things within your plant. And I'll talk a little bit about those later in the humic and fulvic and amino acid question. But they definitely can have instantaneous effects, but there are ways to trigger more effects, both in the plant and the soil microbiome. So Matthew at Sync Angel has talked about it's sort of like a three-way handshake, and there's a few things that have to go down. I'm not 100% sure how it all works, but I do know that a few certain, I guess, elements in the soil have to be correct, but when the direct contact is made between the fungi and the root, the benefits with the plant can be extremely great. Murdog_009 asks, scrogging. I've read so many different articles and how-tos, as well as watching videos. Every single one seems a bit different, but I can't find a definitive technique that shows exactly when to start the scrog. Height, how to scrog in veg, bloom, or even do once the ladies have gone through scrog. I can't seem to get any of these down, and it's frustrating. I'm sure this might be easy to some, but it's very confusing to me. And I could use some help, thanks. In advance, y'all. All right, Murdog, and I'm going to read your follow-up. Can't wait to listen, ASAP. I know growing can be challenging, but I think I got a good handle on it, except scrogging. It's my downfall. Well, it can be a lot of people's downfalls if they don't know what they're doing. Scrogging can cause you more pain than it can cause you pleasure. You can get your plants all tucked into that net, and then you're not able to take them out, and then it can be difficult to water if you don't have a watering system in place, or if you hand water a extendable watering wand. You can make one out of like a PVC pipe with some on and off valves, and the water basically pours into the end of the wand and drips down onto the plants, which is a wonderful solution for if you're growing in a scrog in a tent, for example. For people growing in grow rooms with a scrog, you can prop the scrog up with like a piece of wood to help yourself get under there. Use a little roll around chair, like you can get many different places, but just like a round stool that rolls, and those can help you work underneath the scrog. As far as actually implementing the scrog, it depends cultivar to cultivar. I would say if you want to use a scrog, then I would recommend sativa and sativa hybrids, because there tend to be a little bit branchier plants that have a lot more offshoots on the sides. You can train those offshoots to grow up into the scrog and through the scrog during veg and in flower. And when you're in flower, sativas tend to stretch a little bit more, so the scrog can act as both a support for the heavier, longer colas, as they often tend to get like floppy if they're super long and start to put on some heavier weight later in flower. Some of them can't support their own weight, so the scrog can act just to do that. You can also use the scrog to sort of spread the plant out and get a uniform canopy at the top. Some people use the scrog for this reason, but some people don't. There's not necessarily one perfect right or wrong way. Some people are low maintenance. They just want to throw the scrog up, make sure that their stuff isn't falling over. They're getting adequate light spread and usage across the plant, but other people will go to the absolute maximum. They're mainlining their plant from the get-go. They're training it so that it has a certain amount of tops that they can weave evenly through the scrog. So it all depends on the amount of maintenance that you want to put into the plant. But I would say if you follow the mainlining guide, put on Grow Weed Easy and you use a scrog, then that's a good place to get started because it will give you 8 to 16 top colas, which can be distributed throughout your canopy space per plant. And depending on the number of plants you have and your grow canopy, you can decide how many top colas is appropriate depending on the size of the pot that you're growing in. If you're in soil, a lot of people recommend 3 or 5 gallon pots, even larger sometimes. Coco coir, I found that you can get away with as small as 1 gallon pots and harvest a few ounces off of each plant. But some people are looking for pounds off of each plant, so they want to put them in larger pots, bigger roots, bigger fruits, as we always say. Delta 9 Jack commented, "Is there any real truth to plants not liking to touch borders or each other? I hear the myth, but see so many successful, crowded gardens that I feel like throwing the theory and my OCD-ness out the window and just packing the tent / space to the brim." Laughing / sweating smile emoji. With that said, my follow-up question is, when is it too much plant for the space, and what dictates the capacity? Thanks in advance. At Jack Greenstock, looking forward to the show. Thanks, Delta 9. So that's a great question. I've actually experimented with this myself in my own personal garden. I've grown as few as 2 female plants through flower, and that actually provided me the largest yield. When I've grown more plants in the same space, but many fewer plants, like those 2 plants were grown in 3 gallon coco pots, versus I've done 5 plants in 1 gallon pots, I've done 3 plants in 1 gallon pots, and I've tried 8 plants in 1 gallon coco perlite mix. My tent is only 3 feet by 1.67 feet, or 5 square feet total, and it's only 5 feet tall. So I need to keep my plant height down, and for me, I try to pack the space as tight as I can. If you check out my Instagram or Cannabuzz accounts, you can see I try and pack them in there as tightly as possible. Some people think I pack too much. Some people think I don't pack enough. If you go on Instagram and find at Uncle Reefer, he has a sea of green that is just absolutely unbelievable. He just packs tons and tons of plants in there, but they're all single top colas. And when you do that style of gardening, it's Uncle Dot Reefer. He has 10,000 followers, and just looking at it now, he has 1, 2, 3, 4 by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. He has about 4 plants deep by 12 plants wide. So let's see if I can do math. 12, 24, 36, 48 plants in a space roughly the same size as mine, maybe smaller. They don't have their footprint labeled, at least on this post that I'm looking at, but just eyeballing it, it's kind of impressive to look at when somebody is properly set up a sea of green, how much they can pack in there successfully. With the warning that if you just go in without the proper equipment, you haven't set up your dehumidifier or intake and exhaust fans to account for all the extra humidity from not only the extra plant, but also the extra soil that's waterlogged or cocoa that's waterlogged or whatever medium you're in, there's going to be water, and all of that water going to the plant can transpire out into your room, so you have to be able to account for monitoring that. We talked earlier about powdery mildew. If you try and pack too many plants into the space, like when I did 8 in my 1 gallon pots, they sort of, being next to each other, negatively impacted them because they wanted to grow up. They didn't have enough space to grow out into the sides, so they got taller than I would have liked them. So I decided actually to harvest that run a little bit earlier than I typically would because I was not happy with the results that I was seeing. I have been much better off with 5 plants and 3 plants in the grow space using the 1 gallon pots. But I'm always experimenting. I've also looked at flower beds, like Grassroots makes fabric raised beds, which are great for soil and living organics. I've seen people plant cannabis side by side and it shares the bed, and all the plants look gorgeous and they do very well. So there is also a history of Amsterdam using the Sea of Green, the Dutch, also China throughout history, hundreds, maybe thousands of years ago, has grown plants, not just cannabis, but all sorts of plants, sea of green style, small pots, very close to each other. So the amount of plants that you can fit into your particular grow space, I would say, depends on the cultivar that you're cultivating, as well as the equipment and the style that you're going to train the plant. Like I mentioned earlier, the Scrog King does one plant in a 4x4. If you're going to train a plant like that, you're not going to be able to fit as many plants into the space. So coming to the capacity, it just comes from a philosophy standpoint and what you're ultimately trying to produce. And so I hope that I adequately answered that question for you. One more note for Delta 9 Jack. I just wanted to say, sorry I hadn't followed you back on Instagram. I do try to follow every grower, new or experienced. I like to see people of all levels, and I think I can learn something from people of any level of experience and quality of production. So I finally followed you back on Instagram, found you, and I wanted to follow up with the question. It looks like you've got about a 3x3 grow tent, perhaps, maybe a little larger. If you look into growers on Instagram, like at CanCanGrow, that's CanCanGrow, he does a sea of green style, and he can sort of give you an idea of the number of plants that he fits in his grow space, which might be just a little bit larger than yours, but it can help give an idea of how many you can pack in there. And he's continuing to up the number to see how many he can fit. It can be crazy, like 30 in a 4x4 or even more than that. So he's a good person to check out. And also the last person I'll recommend for you and any of the listeners on Instagram, check out at stunted.art. It's S-T-U-N-T-E-D, stunted. I'm just typing it out, .art, and they demonstrate growing in as small as like shot glass style with autoflowers, and they pack tons of plants. Let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So they pack 50 plants in what looks like a maybe 2.5 by 1.5 space. So it's really incredible what people are capable of doing. The limits are probably not understood entirely yet, so I don't want to give you a definitive answer, because somebody will be like, hey, well, did you know so-and-so is doing this many plants in this square footage? So my number of maybe 5 in a 5-square-foot grow space that I think could be fairly ideal might be way lower than somebody who has, you know, that same 5 square feet of grow space. And by 5 square feet, I mean 3 feet times 1.67, which is the footprint of my tent that I'm growing in for flower. Next up, I got a question, one of several from at DC Grows, my buddy on Instagram, and at Cannabuzz. We've also talked a lot in the DM, so a shout out to DC Grows, G-R-O-W-Z. Dear Jack, would you mind elaborating on the different roots in the plant and their nutrient uptake? Is it true that the longer you let your clones root, the more fishbone roots you get? If so, would this make the plant a slow drinker due to lack of tap roots? Well, DC Grows, I have one thing to say about tap roots and clones. Clones will never have a tap root, no matter how long you allow them to sit. Clones just don't have tap roots because they're not a seed. That is a difference between seeds and clones. So I do want to get to the different types of roots that exist. I'm going to sort of go with 3 different labelings. There is one, a tap root, which is the main tap root that is larger, grows faster than branch roots. 2 is fibrous, with roots about the same size. And 3 is adventitious. I don't know how to pronounce this. It's A-D-V-E-N-T-I-T-I-O-U-S, roots, that form on any plant part other than roots. Fibrous systems are characterized of grasses shallower than taproot systems, found in most eudicots and gymnosperms. Probably pronouncing a lot of those words incorrectly, but those are the 3 types of roots as far as I'm aware scientifically. So the fishbone comment, I think you're referring to maybe the fibrous roots and the one with the A that I was probably mispronouncing. The one with the A sort of fills in the top of the soil with the lighter, fluffier stuff that is almost dusty when you shake out your root ball after harvest. The fibrous are more probably of those fishbone that you're talking about that look like a white fishbone when you see them even poking out of the top of the soil sometimes. They're coming out of the sides. not as thick as the taproot, they don't go as deep as the taproot, but all of them are responsible for nutrient uptake, so you want to make sure that all of them are healthy. Whatever medium you're in, your roots are going to directly have a large impact on the health of your plant. So just keeping that in mind, there are tons of different root products out there. I'm not going to try and direct you to or sell you on any of them, because I think a lot of them are great and work for different people, so you can find the best root products out there for yourself. But just know there are different types of roots, but if you're using clones, you don't have to worry about a taproot. The amount of fishbone types of roots you're getting, the more fibrous ones, the healthier looking ones compared to like the scraggly ones, I would suggest don't want to let your clones get more than a few inches long. If they do, it's not a huge deal. Some people cut them, some people wrap them in their cup, some people try and spread them outwards in their cup when they transplant into a medium, whether it's cocoa or soil. There's a whole lot of different ways to go about doing it. I've found as long as you're using mycorrhizae fungi when you are transplanting, they don't seem to get too shocked. And when they get more space, whenever they're transplanted up, they tend to do a lot better because they like to have space for those roots to go out, especially in flower. As the plant stretches, the roots are also stretching. So having that extra space is really nice if they transplant it in maybe a week or two before they go into flower, so they're used to their new home. They can really take off when they go into flower when they're stretching. I have an additional question from DC Grows that I pulled from our direct messages, and they ask, what's the difference between humic acid and amino acid, and how should they be used in your grow? So, I have a little bit of information about the benefits of both of those things. They both can be used in your grow in different ways. So, the effect of amino acids. Amino acids are primarily used to boost photosynthesis, which we know is important for cannabis or any other plant that is green, that uses light to produce food for itself as energy. Plants synthesize amino acids from primary elements, the carbon, oxygen obtained from the air, hydrogen from the water and the soil, forming carbon hydrate by the means of photosynthesis and combining it with nitrogen, which the plants obtain from the soil, leading to synthesis of amino acids by collateral metabolic pathways. Only L-amino acids are part of these proteins and have metabolic activity. So, with all that scientific jargon being said, amino acids can be used both in the root zone and as well as a foliar feed, and they can both be beneficial. You just have to make sure with whatever amino acid product that you're using it in the right dosage. That depends product to product and amino acid to amino acid, so make sure you do your research on the specific amino acids and the specific concentrations which they should be given to cannabis plants. If you cannot find that, I would suggest that you maybe hold off on that product until you get further, better information. Now, humic acids are something that sort of often happen just in organics. Humic things can come from soils. So just understanding humic acid a little bit and the benefits. Humic acid is a group of molecules that bind to and help plant roots receive water and nutrients. High humic acid levels can dramatically increase yields. Humic acid deficiency can prevent farmers and gardeners from growing crops with optimum nutrition. Conventional wisdom today ignores humic acids, though holding that it is impossible to grow and maintain an urban landscape, such as a park or golf course or lawn, without a high analysis of NPK fertilizers. So basically, this is a Eco-Farming Daily journal that I'm reading right now, just there. And so they talk a little bit about the physics of humic acid and why it's important for the medium, transporting nutrients from the soil to the plants. It also talks about something I mentioned earlier with the mycorrhizal fungi, that when certain depletion zones occur within the root zone, that nutrients can help be uptaken because of the humic acid. So if there's a lack of humic acid or mycorrhizal fungi, then the plant won't be able to take up any nutrients from sort of those more depleted areas or drier areas or areas that the soil nutrient content or proper levels are not exact where you want them to be. There are much better scientifically minded people that can speak on and describe the different benefits of humic acid and amino acid, as well as fulvic acid. Those are the three main acids that I hear about used in gardening. They all have their own individual unique benefits, but for the sake of this show, I don't think that I need to get more esoteric than I already have. This dives really deep down into the scientific rabbit hole, which I like to do sometimes, but only until the point that it sort of informs the gardener on why you would want to use the product and what benefits they might see or receive from using those types of products. I would have commented, but I'm too paranoid. For your next podcast, you think you could go over smell control, like fans, filters, setting them up? I'm trying to blow my tent air downstairs and then filter it again, just in case the first filter doesn't catch the smell good enough. I'm in an illegal state. So, that question, I'm not going to read the name. I'll make a reference that it sort of sounds like it. Yo, yo, dude, number, not close enough so anybody will actually know what your account is, but maybe you'll know after hearing the question that it is indeed your question if you remember writing it in the DMs however long ago. Thank you for the question, by the way. It's been great DMing with you and all the other growers that I get to chat with. As far as smell, paranoia is definitely key in a state that's not legal to grow cannabis, or illegal, or overregulated even. If you have a certain number of plants, even in legal states, sometimes you might be a little bit over your plant count for one reason or another. So with that in mind, carbon filters, I think, are the best way. And a reputable brand that I like is CanFilter. I've had good luck with VivoSun carbon filters, but after each year, you're going to want to replace the filter because they might last a year and a half, but you want to replace them before they go. 1 year is good enough value for me. Personally, there's ways to reactivate them. There's ways to make them yourself at home. I personally like just to have the professionally made ones that I can hang into my grow room. And if it works, then that's awesome. If it stops working and your whole house starts to smell like dank cannabis, then maybe your neighbors don't like that. Maybe somebody outside who doesn't know that you're growing now does know because you blew smell somewhere that you shouldn't have. So I love the idea that you're talking about blowing it downstairs. Great first start. A second carbon filter down there just in case. Better safe than sorry. I think that's totally a good idea. It doesn't cost you that much more. You can set an exhaust fan up on that. And then come trim time, you can use that carbon filter in whatever room you're deciding to trim in. And you just set an exhaust on top of the carbon filter, having it pulling air through the carbon filter next to wherever you and your trim team are located. This will help dramatically reduce the smell and prevent anybody outside that you do not want to know about your smell from coming in. So if it's the police, whether it's your neighbors, whether it's just anybody that you don't want to know about you growing, carbon filters are an excellent way of doing so. I definitely think you are on the right track with using two carbon filters. Make sure you replace them as needed. I think every year is a good safety precaution. One final important note about carbon filters is to be sure that you have the proper size. They make 4-inch, 6-inch, 8-inch, and even larger. Depending on your grow space, you'll want to get the proper size carbon filter. Larger means it can pull in and filter more air, but with that in mind, make sure your exhaust fans are powerful because the carbon filter will draw a sort of sucking force on the exhaust. So with that in mind, you need to run the exhaust at higher levels in order to get the same level of humidity removed from the grow room, same level of air circulation in the grow room. So you might want to have larger fans and carbon filters than you may otherwise expect if you are used to running without a carbon filter. That's a tip for maybe you and anybody else who's concerned. A little bit bigger sometimes is better, especially with the ones that you can dial down. If it has some sort of remote control, you can always have your carbon filter on there, which will even in veg prevent any of the smells that are coming out of the grow room. It's a better safe than sorry situation. You always want to make sure that you're being safe and not risking the security of yourself, your family, and having a military-style raid coming into your house, causing thousands of worth damage, and also maybe potentially giving you, your family, PTSD, separating you from your kids. Growing in illegal states is very risky and serious, so I don't want anyone to take that lightly. I do not necessarily suggest that anybody do it, but for those that are going to already, they're going to be able to hear these podcasts and get the advice one way or another. The fact that they chose to disclose, I respect, so I'm not going to dox them or give out their name. Want to make sure that we can keep all of our listeners safe and give them the best advice possible. So with that being said, maybe try and advocate legally at the local level for medical cannabis, because more and more states are tipping, and if you can be on the front, join Normal. Normal has groups active all throughout the country. They can help you advocate and hopefully make it so when cannabis rights do come around to your place, you don't get screwed over with some bad laws. You want to make sure that you're on the forefront helping them write positive cannabis laws that allow for home grow and allow for people like yourself to have good access to clean medicine. The next question I'm going to lump together comes from Big Low CB4 on my Instagram post, as well as at Sync Angel. Big Low asks, LST and defoliating maybe. So they were suggesting that as a topic. Now I'm just going to scroll down and get to Matthew at Sync Angel. He's also known as Zenthanol on YouTube. He's sort of an IPM expert. He writes, how about basic plant physiology in regards to cultivation practices like defoliation and how that might affect things like photosynthesis, CO2 assimilation, and transpiration? Great questions, both of you. So, starting with the comment on LST, I personally think LST, or low stress training, as you know if you listen to the dictionary episode, which you, if you haven't, go back and listen to episode 0, that will help you with some of the terms that you might not have understood so far in this episode. And it's got a dictionary for the first 30 or so minutes, and then at 37 minutes in, I give you a little brief bit about my own history in the cannabis space. But Big Low's asked LST and defoliating maybe. So LST, low stress training, I think is absolutely mandatory. I think if you're growing cannabis plants and trying to maximize your space and you're not doing a sea of green where you're just growing single top colas with limited to no training, then you're probably going to be doing low stress training, which means bending the plant over in order to provide light to spots on the plant that may otherwise not be getting it, and also to break sort of the apical dominance or direct growth upwards that cannabis plants want to have, that sort of Christmas tree style, one big fat top cola. By using LST or low stress training, we can bend the plant over, grow it into a more desirable shape, and that will allow us to have much larger yields and just more uniform plants. I've found that by doing the LST on some of the branches that I bend and even do things like super cropping or high stress training, that those buds tend to produce even a little bit more frosty looking and more flavorful, more potent buds at the end of the day. I don't have much data or science to prove it, but I think, as Rasta Jeff of Grow From Your Heart podcast says, if it's kind of like a person. If you push somebody, they naturally will stand and widen out their base with their feet. They spread their legs apart. And the same thing kind of goes for cannabis with its roots. Like, if you take a plant and set it in a room with no fan on it, it's going to kind of grow shrimpy and not the strongest. But if you put a little bit of a fan, it forces it to sort of balance itself out and grow out more roots to be stronger. I think the same sort of applies for LST and high stress training. If you can sort of manipulate the plant and break it down, sort of like a muscle, you break the muscle down when you're lifting the weight, allow it to recover, and it builds back stronger than before. Same concept with training the plant. Like, when you pop and make that knuckle, although it's weak for a day or two, or maybe a week, as soon as it bounces back, I think that knuckle allows more nutrients to flow through the pathway. And it also, I definitely know, can support more weight at the end of the harvest. The colas that have the super crops, or even the LST, tend to not break over and fall off, but the ones that I don't touch or influence will tend to be a little bit less supportive of their own weight. Now, moving on to defoliation. Defoliation tends to have a lot of controversy associated with it. It could mean anything from removing a few leaves to schwazing, or removing basically all of the fan leaves that are not the primary ones on the bud sites. And I've done experiments where you can see my Sour 76 run. I pretty much did the mango tech, where on day 21 of flower, I took off all the large fan leaves, and day 42 of flower, took off all the large fan leaves again. And I think it can provide a more dense appearing bud. It may, in fact, with some cultivars, hurt the yield. But I think with other cultivars, it can, in fact, increase the yield, depending on what you're talking about. If we're talking about just dried grade A bud that you would want to see in a jar, stuff that you're going to smoke and not make into concentrates, the defoliating technique, I think, definitely produces more of those top quality looking buds visually. As far as amount of yield, I think if you do less or even no defoliation, you can get more larf and fan leaves, which if you're making concentrates or hash or edibles and things like that, you may say, well, I'm not going to defoliate because I feel like I'm losing out on some of the yields on things that I can get otherwise. Now, I'm going to pull up my phone and find Matt's comment again because he talked about things specifically, such as the transpiration being affected. That's one reason a lot of people like to do defoliation, because when you remove leaves, they are no longer transpiring. So they're no longer putting that humidity out into the grow room. That makes it easier for some people to manage, like we were talking about earlier with Sea of Greens, where they're packing tons and tons of plants into smaller spaces. If they remove some of the leaves or a lot of the leaves, it drops the RH in the room. Relative humidity goes down. They're less likely to get mold, bud rot, whole bunch of different things. So that could be a main reason. CO2 assimilation. Yeah, when you remove a fan leaf from a plant, you are taking away some of its ability to assimilate CO2. That could negatively affect the plant, but it is yet to be studied scientifically, the exact levels and amounts in cannabis. So I'm still waiting on the science behind it to prove or disprove whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But I've seen a lot of people have success. So I think I wouldn't discourage other people from doing it. Looking at someone like Grow Weed Easy, who commonly does pretty heavy defoliation, they're getting upwards of 1.4 to 1.6 grams per watt. And that's pretty efficient grown cannabis. So I'll just throw that out there as far as anybody trying to disprove and say that it makes the plants yield poorly. If you're not harvesting at least that much, maybe their techniques have shown to be better, or they just have better cultivars, or maybe they're weighing in a different way than you do. Whatever the reason may be, you know, the defoliation thing brings up a lot of arguments and makes people feel sort of heated in some types of way. And so I don't want anybody to sort of rage and hate me for my comments and my feelings about this, but I do think defoliation can have positive benefits, but typically they do better when using synthetic fertilizer. I make this comment because a lot of organic growers will say, hey, I defoliated and it completely screwed my yield, which may in fact be the case, because in organic growing, the nutrient uptake is a little bit slower and the plant relies more on the fan leaves as a storage for the foods and sugars and things like that. And hence why when you see the flush, the fan leaves start to fade, the plant is sort of pulling from those leaves, as far as I understand, to support the buds or the, you know, reproductive part of the plant. Just like if you were locked in a freezer, your hands start to die off and your feet start to die off before your testicles or ovaries would, because your body is naturally trying to protect its survival. Just like the plant is trying to protect its own survival, the bud or even the male pollen sacs, those are the part of the plant that's the most important to the plant, not the leaf. So when you're removing a leaf, you're taking away some of its storage. It could act as a solar panel, but if it's acting as a solar panel that's blocking lower bud sites, that's where the main debate comes in. Green light can penetrate some of the canopy, but also removing leaves could prevent leaves from laying on top of each other. There's so many different situations in which defoliation or even strategic pruning, whatever you want to call it, can be effective or necessary, because if you don't do it, then you might end up with negative consequences where it could be worse than just negatively impacting your yield a small percentage, if that is even the case, which I haven't necessarily seen data to prove or disprove either way. I've seen people have success with it and say it increased their yield versus their trial plant, and I've also had people say that it ruined their yield versus their trial plant. So I would say it's up to the individual grower to try it for themselves, see how much, when, what style of defoliation and growing in general that they like, because there are 100 different ways to do it. It's sort of like an art. You can give somebody a paintbrush and a canvas, and everybody's going to paint a different picture, even if you give them the exact same paint, exact same canvas, sit them in the same room in front of the same sunset. We all sort of do it a different way, and especially when you're interacting with a live thing, like a plant, it has sort of a mind of its own. It'll grow in its own shape, way, color, take in different nutrients. Like, they're all very unique, and I think that things like that cannot be overlooked when trying to comment on the effectiveness of things like defoliation. Next up from the American Cultivator, we have a lighting question. Maybe some deep conversation on lighting. I've picked a bunch of people's brains about what lights they use. No one has the same exact answer. Absolutely no one. And everyone I've asked has some of the best stuff I've seen. So there are many ways to go with the convo. I've learned a lot, but still only scraped the surface. Now, lighting is something I do plan to do an entire episode on. However, I do want to answer this briefly here. Now, with lighting, there's a few things to be concerned with. The spectrum of your light, which is going to be like a Kelvin reading. It could be like a 3000K, 3500K, 4000K. Those are all different spectrums that you might see of LED that are like a white light. Ceramic metal halide or light emitting ceramic, they have a 3100K and 4200K spectrum, which are a cool and warm light spectrum. High pressure sodium often come in about 2000 Kelvin color spectrum. It's a little bit more reddish orange. Metal halides are anywhere from, I believe they're 5000 or 4000. I don't have the exact Kelvin spectrum in front of me, but I know that they're more blue. There are also finishing bulbs that I've seen that have 10K spectrum, and there are mixed spectrum bulbs like some of the box LED import bulbs that I think are pretty inefficient. They have just red and blue because they've tried to argue that those are the most efficient PAR points, or photosynthetically active radiation points. PAR is what your plants can use of the light that they're provided. So if it's within the right color spectrum, they're able to use it for photosynthesis. So what that means is you can use something like a PAR meter to see how much PAR your light puts out at a canopy. Somebody has already done this, thankfully for me. There are a few different channels. Migro on YouTube, M-I-G-R-O, he tests his own as well as other lights on video with probably one of the best sensors that you can buy to show their spectrum, as well as the amount of PAR they put out at the canopy, as well as the amount of wattage drawn. That's an important comment to know, because many people buy, like, Vipar Spectra is a light on Amazon. It's a blue and red LED like the ones I mentioned earlier. It's an import, probably from China, fairly inexpensive lights, so a lot of people are drawn to them, especially when getting into the new home growing. But they use really old, inefficient LEDs that unfortunately don't even stack up to some of the old bulb technology, like high-pressure sodium or metal halides. So things like that are important to consider. Migro has done like best light of 2018, best light of 2019. The way that he measures this is by looking at the PAR it puts out on the canopy and then dividing that by the wattage, which gives you what's called micromoles. It looks like U-M-O-L-E when it's written out on Instagram or wherever you'll see it typed, but it's actually micromule. And that's just describing the reading that of PAR, the amount. So like 700 to 1000 are the high end sort of that you want before supplementing CO2 in flower. That's the highest amount of light intensity that cannabis plants typically will do well under. In veg, they can do well with anywhere from like 300 to 400, even less in some occasions. The reason that this is important is it sort of has a fair comparison across all the lights, because it looks at how much wattage they're drawing versus how much PAR they're putting out. And that PAR is photosynthetically active radiation again. And that's what you want your plants to do, is, you know, do photosynthesis. That's what the light is there for. It's supposed to be acting as your sun. So with that in mind, you know, the ones that, for example, a high pressure sodium light that pulls 1,000 watts might put out a certain amount of PAR. And if you compare that to a 600 watt modern LED from something like Horticulture Lighting Group or Timber Grow Lights or Migro or Optic LED, any of these other things, these high-end companies now that are producing really, really efficient LEDs, they're getting over 2 PPFD per watt. And that's photosynthetic something, photon flux, PPFD per watt. And that's similar to, it's just telling you how much PAR is being put out to the canopy versus the amount of wattage drawn. And those are the measurements that you're going to have to try and calculate. Many companies won't just outright tell you. You're going to have to find the real PAR or the real actual wattage drawn, because like Vipar Spectra might say 600 watt, but it's actually a 230 watt light. Where HLG says HLG 550, and it's actually pretty close to a 550 watt light. So you have to make sure you know what company you're buying from and consider those things. On the budget spectrum, I think most people would be very well off with ceramic metal halide, CMH, or light-emitting ceramic bulbs. I think that for the cost, they do very well. They're a little bit of a step up from the high-pressure sodium. I think that they provide a better color spectrum for you to work under with a true white tone. It's easier to see plant deficiencies. It's easier on your eyes. And I just think
from the side-by-side test I've seen done by Cali Crop Doc on YouTube, he showed that his high-pressure sodium lights actually provided with the same clones, same nutrients, everything else held the same. High-pressure sodium was about 1 to 2% lower test results on the dry cannabis that was tested versus the ceramic metal halide that he used. So when I switched, I was actually very surprised and impressed with the ceramic metal halide results. But now I am currently cultivating using a Timber Grow Light cob or chip on board LED style. Abolished Farms writes, I'd like to see a terpene focused episode, or maybe someone to show how to do jar tech with solventless. So I do have a terpene episode planned in the future, but I'll cover a few of my favorite terpenes, just the ones that I know off the top of my head without referencing any notes, and some of their effects and their smells for people that might be interested, because they do have awesome medical effects and they have great flavor, and I think that they are the most distinct part of cannabis that makes each cultivar unique and which makes each person go back to a particular strain or cultivar. So with that said, my favorite terpene is pinene or alpha pinene. There's also a beta pinene. Alpha pinene has been shown to help increase memory retention and alertness, and it counteracts some of the forgetfulness effects that we have from THC. THC binds at the spot on your brain known to release a chemical called anandamide. Anandamide is important if you're like a fry cook and you take orders all day. You don't want to remember those for the rest of your life. So your brain has to have a chemical that makes you forget tedious, unimportant things. But when you get, you know, medicated with certain types of cannabis, the anandamide stays in the cell for longer. And that causes people to be forgetful with things like where they put their keys, where they put their cell phone or their sunglasses. Silly little stuff like that, which is funny to laugh about in retrospect, but for someone like me who's got concussions, I deal with that enough already. So I don't want my medicine to be compounding my forgetfulness. I already have a tough enough time, as I'm sure many others do. Memory is not great. That's why we should write things down and record them. Almost nobody has as good of a memory as they would like to admit, but with all that being said, pinene is a great way to supplement memory. It's also known as a bronchodilator, which helps people with asthma. Back in the day, they used to have cannabis cigarettes, which, although smoking is harmful on the lungs, the pinene was so beneficial it actually helped the people with asthma open up their lungs and breathe better. So that's just a little tip of history. Pinene smells like pine, which is nice because it goes with a name. Often it's found in pine needles. In Japan, Dr. Ethan Russo often quotes there's a thing called Shinrin-yoku, known as forest bathing, where people with stressful lives will go and take a walk through a pine forest just to inhale the pinene and help de-stress and like calm them down and bring focus, and you know, it really can have a positive effect. And I think that's why so many people do enjoy going on hikes and in nature, not just the pinene, but all of the different flowers and different terpenes and things that are flying around through the air in nature that make you feel good, that fresh air, that sunshine, all those like little things, the vitamin D that you're getting, it all adds up. But terpenes are definitely a major role in that. And they also are a major modifying thing with cannabis, because in Dr. Ethan Russo's Taming THC, he mentions the entourage effect. When he looked at THC on its own, which is known as Marinol, and CBD on its own, which is Epidiolex, it's actually a mix, which has some terpenes, because they've realized the full spectrum and whole plant medicine is often more effective than when we just derive the specific cannabinoids on their own. So terpenes often, in certain amounts, are having certain effects. Another one that I'll go to is called linalool. Linalool is often found in lavender. There was a study done on mice where they pumped them full of caffeine. They saw that their activity level went up 40 to 55%. And I believe it was 55%. Now, when they started giving the mice lavender essential oils with caffeine, their activity level only went up 5%. When they used linalool, the terpene on its own, their activity level with the caffeine only went up 20 or 30%. And there was another essential oil part in lavender that they used that also had a similar effect, but not as strong as the whole plant lavender essential oil together. So this often is used as a reference point for how the entourage effect can be shown in different settings. And although it is with mice, that has a significant correlation, as you see many of the healthcare products that are marketed towards sleep often have lavender or linalool in them because they have been proven in many different lab studies to have that sort of relaxing sedative effect. In regards to terpenes, I have a very helpful tool that I use in my garden. It's a poster from leafly.com that I actually purchased. It was like $15 and it's about the size of a door. But I have it next to my grow room because I love to smell the plants and then look up, because it has like 50 different flavors and smells that, you know, you might be able to smell on your plant. And when you do the stem rub and you smell your fingers, it's good to reference over. And it has a few of the different prominent terpenes. I already listed alpha pinene. I already listed linalool. I'm going to go on to limonene. And limonene has been found in citrus like orange, lemon, and lime. So whenever you scratch your thumb on a citrus rind, you are going to be smelling limonene. That is often used in cleaners and several different essential oil products for cleaning. It's been shown to have positive, happy, uplifting effects. Limonene is one of the more common terpenes found in cannabis, probably the highest in some sativas. When you smell citrus, then limonene is primarily responsible. Myrcene. Now, myrcene is something that's responsible for the sedative effects. And myrcene is going to smell earthy, like cloves or like wood. And that might be a little bit difficult for some people to imagine. It can also be pungent herbal citrus. Myrcene is known for the couch lock effect. So a lot of cannabis cultivars of modern day are known for having high myrcene. And that high myrcene is actually what makes them feel sort of stoned and pulled down and sort of heavy and sedative. And some people like that narcotic effect. And at the end of the day, it's great. It can help with insomnia. It can help with pain. So it definitely has its place. But if you're trying to study or if you're trying to get work done around the house, it's something that can actually be a detriment to you. So when people are selecting their medicine, it's very important for them, if they're able to, get access to terpene test results. If they're not able to, hopefully they can smell the cannabis before they can buy it. If not, buy in small amounts. Then, you know, learn the smells, learn to identify the different things that you like and the effects that come along with those smells, because oftentimes they are in a profile. So if you like Jack Herrera, for example, Jack has a certain smell to it. It's got some pinene, it's got some limonene. OG Kush has a little bit of limonene. It's got some myrcene. It's got caryophyllene, which is the next one I'll go into. Caryophyllene is the spicy terpene. It smells like pepper, wood, or spice. It can be found in a lot of the haze varieties. It can be found in a lot of the old landrace varieties. It's often referred to as like the frankincense or incense terpene. It's very distinct, and when you smell it, it'll whack you right in the face. It, along with terpenoline. Terpenoline is something that you can smell sort of in apples and nutmeg. It's got a pine, flowery, and herbal smell. So I've gone into a few of the primary terpenes that are found in cannabis and given you some of the ideas of some of the strains that have them. Like Blue Dream is one that I really enjoy. It's got high pinene, but it's also got some of the more sedative things, so it helps me focus, but also helps me to relax. Difficult to find that sometimes. You have to try a bunch of different strains to really find out what you like, but terpenes are sort of the new thing, and there are companies that are extracting terpenes, whether it's from cannabis or other things, and pumping them into cannabis products. So we're going to be seeing a lot more stuff marketed based on a terpene and based on the effect that has been shown to be associated with that terpene. So look out for that. Learn what they smell like. Learn what you like. Learn the ratios. And I will be doing a full deep dive episode onto terpenes sometime in the future on Greenstock Talks. But for now, I'm going to wrap it up on terpenes and get into the final questions about the history of cannabis. So a bit like the last question, I do plan to do cannabis history episodes on their own, because I want to make them distinct and individual, so they're easier to find for the listener and they're not buried at the end of a hour, 20-minute questions podcast. But I will go over for Sequence3_MI, as well as Chef OMJ and one other person. Let me find who asked that history question here in just a second. Chef OMJ writes, "How or who do you think started growing the fire strains? How do you think the Can of Cavemen figured it out? I'm actually going to answer that one, but I just want to continue scrolling to find, if only it grew like my beard. Asked, you know what I find really interesting when someone talks about strains, strain history, where the strain came from, who helped develop it, that person, I just think that's a huge part of the culture, and not everybody knows. And I know that information, a lot of information like that. I know that you have a lot of information like that. Cheers, can't wait to hear the new episode. I do have a lot of information like that, so I do want to share sort of how I've come to find it. One of the best ways is to read. There are Canna Bibles. There are books that list strains like Subcool's Big Book of Dank and Big Book of Dank Volume 2, where he describes the history of some of the strains that he's worked with personally, where he got them from, where the stories that he has been told. DJ Short has a book, Breeding Excellent Cannabis. In there, he talks about the heritage strains, which are some land races and some really long-standing strains. Sam the Skunk Man comes on Hash Church, and he talks about some of the histories of cannabis strains and like Skunk Number 1 being one of the early ones. Cali O is one of the early ones from Cultivator Choice Seed Bank. So continuing on, going to Chef's Point, Chef OMJ on Instagram. They wrote the question about the fire strains and where they started in the Canna Cavemen. How did they figure it out? So I think for thousands of years, cannabis has been cultivated, and there are better people that know the exact history, like Mel Frank and Robert Connell Clark have gone and dived down in like the thousands of years old history. I'm more interested in the modern history personally, because I can see what certain hash producing countries have made and their plants and how they look and how they smoke and how they taste and how they smell. And I can look at modern cultivars and how we've made hybrids and how different countries like Amsterdam and how the United States and how Canada and Jamaica and how many different areas throughout the country have their own cannabis history. And a major, major thing that impacts sort of all of it, I think, is between Sam the Skunk Man and Shanti Baba and Neville Schoonmaker, because what Neville did with the seed bank, which was then called Sensi Seeds, and like Ben Dronkers got involved, and there was a whole bunch of other business people who got involved. But with that history, if you look back throughout the 90s with High Times magazine and Sensi Seed Bank, they sent hundreds or thousands of seeds to different growers all throughout different parts of the world. And that sort of allowed those growers to breed themselves. And then they bred their own stuff. And that's where a lot of the history began, is that Neville had a really, really good stock, some of it which was brought over by Sam the Skunk Man, some of it which they developed themselves by growing acres and greenhouses and a whole bunch of different ways. You can look into the history of that on your own deeper, and I don't want to go too long in this podcast. I'm already at about an hour and a half in. But like I said, I'm planning on doing future episodes about specific strains. The way that I find them, a good resource is at, if you listen to podcasts like this one, you might enjoy the_pot_cast on Instagram, or the podcast. It's with a Australian guy. He interviews lots of breeders, talks about where they got started, what strains they're known for, and that can give you a good idea of the history. There are places like Leafly, which occasionally have correct information. Oftentimes it's incorrect. Seedfinder.eu has some good information, but also can be incorrect. It's like Wikipedia. Anybody can post these things. Anybody can update them sometimes. So we get some accurate information. Plus, the illegality of cannabis makes it tricky to pin down the exact origins of some of these stories. But I do have a lot of them. I just want to make sure to share them on specific episodes so people can find that content. And that way, they'll be able to be most informed about which strains, where they come from, what they do for me, what they might have done for other people that I've served in the past, being a medical cannabis delivery person, as well as a bud tender, as well as a grower and consultant. So with that being said, this episode is running a little bit longer than my typical shows, but I'm really happy to have dived into what I'll call part one of Dear Jack, because definitely plan to do this again in the future. One of the main reasons I got into podcasting was to help answer questions from new and veteran growers alike. This is one of my favorite things to do, is connect with the community, help, and by helping, I actually end up learning, because I dive deeper into topics that I might not have previously considered. So thank you all for listening. Thank you for writing questions and leaving feedback. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you leave thumbs up and positive feedback, or negative feedback. If you think that there are things that I can improve on, it won't hurt me. I've got thick skin, so go ahead and let me know what you'd like to see changed or improved in the future shows. I've already benefited from that because I was told that the first episode, it was too quiet, and there was some buzzing in the background, so I was able to hopefully make some of those corrections. Hopefully the audio quality is a little bit better for you now. I'm trying to do everything I can to get that as best as possible. You can find me on Canabuzz at Jack Greenstock. You can find me on Instagram at Jack Greenstock. I use the hashtag Greenstock Talks whenever I'm posting about this particular podcast, but you can also find me on the Growing With My Fellow Growers live show most Sundays at 4 p.m. West Coast time. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate all of the questions, and I look forward to doing this and other shows again in the future.